70 years ago this week, the U.S. annihilated Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the world's first and only atomic attack on civilians. Was it necessary to end World War II?
Truman and his cabinet, his administration, had to come up with a justification for the bomb. They justified it on the grounds that it avoided a land invasion and saved all these lives. It was a post facto piece of propaganda. We've been hearing this lie for almost 70 years, and it's about time someone pointed out this is a fabrication of the truth.
That's Paul Hamm. We spend most of the hour with him talking about his new book, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, The Real Story of the Atomic Bombings and Their Aftermath. We also listen back to an excerpt from last year's interview with Naomi Klein about her book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. It's just out in paperback from Simon & Schuster. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and also on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. This week marks the 70th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by the U.S. More than 100,000 men, women, and children were killed outright in the nuclear infernos that resulted. Hundreds of thousands more died in ensuing years from radiation-induced sickness. The official story is that the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were necessary to end the war. But by the summer of 1945, Japan was already defeated, strangled by a U.S. blockade, its Manchurian territory fallen to Soviet troops, its military might spent, and its population starving. The only demand it made in return for surrender was that the life of its emperor, Hirohito, be spared, a condition fulfilled without fuss after the bombs were dropped and Japan sued for peace. So why were the bombs dropped on two cities with no military targets to speak of and without any warning that could have spared civilian lives? That's the question my guest, historian and journalist Paul Hamm, examines in his new book, Hiroshima, Nagasaki. His detailed narrative draws on a vast trove of documents that have become unclassified in recent decades, as well as interviews with survivors, statesmen, and scientists. In it, he paints a compelling picture of the choices facing those who developed and deployed the bomb, and the profound moral failure of the choice they made. Paul Hamm is a historian and the Australia correspondent of the Sunday Times of London. He specializes in the 20th century history of war, politics, and diplomacy. In addition to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, his books include 1914, The Year the World Ended, Vietnam, The Australian War, and Kokoda. Paul Hamm, your book, Hiroshima Nagasaki, The Real Story Behind the Atomic Bombings and Their Aftermath, centers on the question of why and how the U.S. came to accept the notion that inflicting mass casualties on a civilian population in this way was not only an acceptable but even desirable tactic in war. You talk about the firebombing of German cities as playing a role in preparing the ground for the dropping of the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I wonder if you could connect the dots for us.
The air war over Germany and Japan, which was going on 1944 to 8th of May 45 in Germany, and throughout the first half of 1945 in Japan, this was a prescribed strategy to destroy the morale of the civilian life of the actual people in Germany and Japan. None of the commanders were under any illusion that they were striking, they were trying to hit military targets. It was a strategy which was totally planned, conceived, and executed with the intention of completely destroying civilian morale by wiping out the cities. And the bombers flying over the soldiers' heads at the front line, well, they knew they were heading to their homes, they were heading to German and Japanese homes to destroy women and children and the elderly, and the purpose of which was, as I say, to destroy morale. Now, this went on for many months, and in Germany, every major city was reduced to rubble, with millions of people left homeless, hundreds of thousands of casualties, And the similar air war over Japan was launched in early 1945. This was far more lethal. 66 Japanese cities were completely incinerated using a kind of bomb. It's a proto-napalm, which is banned today. Napalm is obviously a banned weapon. But in those days, this was the early incarnation of napalm. It was designed to create horrific fires, which would burn the cities to the ground. They were mostly made of cardboard and paper, after all, in Japan. And the destruction of Tokyo in March 1945, in one night it took to wipe out a large section of the residential area with more than 100,000 dead in one night, the worst casualty count, body count in history to that point from an aggressive action. And, you know, that strike was planned when the winds were high so that the fireball, or the firestorm, would spread throughout the city. So the atomic bombs have to be seen in the context of a progressive destruction of civilian life to destroy the morale of the enemy. And this is one of the reasons why, when the bombs were actually dropped, the commanders of the government in Tokyo, in a war bunker, in a shelter in Tokyo, didn't believe it. They shrugged their shoulders, thought another two cities have been wiped out. They thought it was the standard bombers, the conventional bombardment. So I'm sort of giving you a sketch of, I suppose, drawing the dots, as you put it, certainly as best I can, to show that this was all part of a context of annihilating cities. Now, one of the key things that happened in July 1945 is that Admiral Halsey drew up offshore, off the coast of Japan with his aircraft carriers and sent his aircraft to continue the bombing of Japan, and realized that a fair amount of the military targets hadn't yet been destroyed, because General Curtis LeMay had been for 6 months focusing on destroying innocent civilians. So that was when Halsey realized in July, this is a month before the atomic bombs were used, that he would, you know, do what was necessary to end the war, that is, to destroy the coal ferries, which were delivering coal between the Japanese islands, to destroy the remaining kamikaze airports, which could unleash a few thousand kamikaze planes, and various factories, which were, you know, making weapons. So that just illustrates, and he was appalled. I mean, Halsey thought that this civilian destruction was not going to win the war, and from a purely military standpoint, it didn't work. Civilians stood firm. The nation stood firm. Germany did not buckle. It wasn't destruction of their cities that destroyed Germany. It was the invasion of France through ground troops. The lesson, I suppose, to Japan and Germany and to the Allies was the precedent of Great Britain during the Blitz, where the British people were also subjected to terror bombing of civilians, and we know what happened there. They stood firmer than they'd ever been to resist German invasion, and the same spirit of defiance certainly animated the German people and the Japanese people. So it didn't work even from military terms.
And you actually point out in the book that the military leaders who were not involved in the bomb project, like Eisenhower and MacArthur, were actually opposed, of course, in this case, after the fact, because they were not involved in the decisions leading up to it, but were actually opposed to this policy.
They were. And I think also with a fair dollop of personal ego thrown in, because they wanted to win the war their way. And certainly MacArthur hoped to lead the putative land invasion, which was effectively cancelled or indefinitely postponed in early July 1945, 6 weeks before certainly 2 weeks before the atomic bomb was tested and 6 weeks before it was dropped. So he had hoped the invasion would go ahead. Truman had no intention of greenlighting an invasion once he saw the casualties in Okinawa. Why invade an essentially defeated nation? I mean, why give the samurai what they wanted, which was martyrdom, and to go down in a sort of hellish final struggle on their homeland? I mean, this is why Truman effectively cancelled the invasion. So MacArthur was left after the war, saying, well, the atomic bomb did not end the war, the invasion would have done, but he believed that the naval blockade, the U.S. Navy had ringed Japan in its ships, in its navy, and was stopping trade from going in and out, stopping Japanese troops from returning home, and also, of course, the Russian invasion, but we'll get to that. I'm sorry, I'm expanding on your question. There's a lot of this in my head at the moment. But if I could say, certainly there were many others at the time who rejected the argument that the atomic bombs had in and of themselves ended the war. And MacArthur, Halsey was of the same view. And even Curtis LeMay believed that the atomic weapons were not necessary, that had he continued his conventional firebombing the Japanese cities, that would have won the war. But as I say, these were highly very powerful, highly egocentric men who believed that their strategy was going to be the ultimate victor.
Yeah, mentioning Curtis LeMay, was he not the same Curtis LeMay who was involved in the bombing of Vietnam and before that in pushing a policy of nuclear retaliation against Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962?
That's right. That's the same man. Yeah, I wrote a book on the Vietnam War, actually. He certainly haunted that war as well with his extraordinary conviction that aerial bombardment, mass aerial bombardment, destruction of civilian life would win the war, when the glaring evidence to the contrary was clear to most intelligent observers after World War II.
Paul Hamm, in your book, Hiroshima Nagasaki, you mention a high-level meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on June 18, 1945, which raised the prospect of the invasion of Japan. You write that Truman had no intention of mounting an invasion. Talk about the issues around that, and then put into context the fact that after the bomb was dropped, Truman said that he dropped the bomb in order to avoid an invasion, but it seems that he never had any intention of doing it in the first place.
Yes, this narrative is very interesting because it demonstrates precisely the use by many politicians to justify the past through by invoking a new argument or new information later or sheer wishful thinking after the event. I mean, post facto justification of the atomic bomb. Clearly, he needed to justify it in some way, because by 1947, people were getting very upset and very worried about the soaring rate of radiation deaths in Japan, and certainly the press now were uncensored, and so they were reporting this. But I'll just address your initial point. Certainly, in June 1945, there was a chief of staff meeting, and which Truman chaired, and the point of which was to canvass views about a planned invasion. Now, the invasion was being planned. I mean, planning doesn't imply intent to actually execute the plan. It simply means the plan is being in place. Certainly, many readers have pointed out to me that their grandfather or their father was on a ship off Japan waiting for the green light to invade. I mean, of course, they were amassing the greatest flotilla, the greatest fleet of ships that the world had seen. And so it was Russia was pouring across the Siberian wastelands towards Japan. So the country was being encircled. Now, this doesn't mean that they were actually going to launch a land invasion. And although the chiefs of staff it was a very complicated and long meeting. But just to summarize, their view was that it probably should go ahead, but Truman hadn't made his mind up. And he didn't make his mind up. And he waited for further information. And he certainly waited for a clear picture of what the casualties might be. Now, at that meeting, the estimated casualties – now, we've got to remember, casualties means dead, wounded, and missing in action. So the total casualties estimated at 31,000 in the first month. Now, this is a brutal game of calculation, and it is to your listeners, I'm sure it's going to sound harsh, but this was the kind of language at the time, and this is the brutal reality of total war against Japan. Now, subsequently, a few days after that, the chiefs of staff began raising their estimates. There's been a whole lot of argument about this, a great deal written on this, but they raised their estimates to about 90,000 casualties. But the exact figure varies depending on who you speak to. Also, Herbert Hoover had submitted a calculation of his own to Truman, estimating 500,000 casualties. Some misinterpreted this as 500,000 dead. others, Marshall himself, General Marshall, Truman after the war claimed that General Marshall had estimated 500,000 to a million casualties. Now, we've got to put this in context because at the time, the combat force that was to be used against Japan in a land invasion was estimated to be about 750,000. Now, this is very important because if you have 750,000 men landing in Japan, if you have casualties of, let's say, 500,000 or 500,000 dead, as people after the war were saying, that implies total casualties of 3 to 4 times that, which is, you know, 3 million, 2 million dead. Now, that is double or 3 times or 4 times the number of soldiers who were earmarked to actually land in Japan, which is absolutely ludicrous. I mean, this is school arithmetic. And it has been comprehensively denounced and ridiculed by many commentators since the war. But there is now a new guard, I suppose, of I call them revisionists, because they're revising the facts of the time into their own argument, which is that, yes, there were going to be 500,000 to a million dead. And this has been cursing America for 70 years, this ludicrous figure. Now, it is an absolute insult to the American Armed Forces that they would have sustained 500,000 to a million dead invading. Let's speak to their egos. I mean, this is one of the greatest armies that had ever been assembled in 1945. The idea that they would be annihilated 3 times over by a country that was on its knees, whose people were starving, who hadn't any air force left, a few kamikaze planes, and no navy, is absolutely ludicrous. And for anyone to sustain that argument, apart from being plainly not reading the documents, is wanting to believe a narrative that simply didn't exist at the time. So after the war, this is when we get to the point of your question, really. After the war, then Truman and particularly the former Secretary of War, Stimson, sort of dusted down an argument that they had to drop the bomb to avoid an invasion which would have cost America 500,000 to a million dead, effectively 2 million to 4 million casualties. Now, this is an extraordinary event because this was expressed essentially in a number of articles which came out in 1947 when public anxieties about the bomb were rising. And certainly the stories coming out of Japan were horrific and extreme. I mean, massive deaths from radiation-related cancers, which peaked in the early 50s, leukemias related to the bomb, were actually at their peak in the early 50s. So there's a lot of anxiety about that. A lot of the American conscience was certainly piqued by this. And so the government of the day had to do something to answer these concerns, especially from the church as well. I mean, the Catholic Church was the first out of the block to condemn the bomb. So there followed many other Christian churches, but also Jewish faith. People were condemning the bomb roundly. So Truman then, as I say, came up with an article in Stimson's name, the war secretary's name, in Harper's Magazine, which sought to justify the use of the bomb. And this made clear that it was used as an alternative to a land invasion. Now, as I've hopefully made clear, the land invasion was postponed indefinitely, if not cancelled. I suppose the word shelved is what I use in my book, in early July. That is 2 weeks before the actual bomb was tested. So it was never a case of either an invasion or the bomb. Truman was simply not going to go ahead and risk that many casualties. I've said 90,000, which was closer to the figure. That in itself is a horrendous loss of life of American manhood. And, it was double more than double the losses at Okinawa. And it wasn't democratically sustainable, let alone the tragedy to all the families. So why would he risk that and perhaps many more casualties? They could have gone to a couple of 100,000. We just don't know. But this was a defeated country. They had no air force. They had no navy. And the army as it stood, I mean, the majority of the Japanese army were landlocked in China and Manchuria, and they couldn't get home. So what I'm really getting at is now that there was a lot of public anxiety in 1947, Truman and his cabinet, his administration, had to come up with a justification for the bomb. They justified it on the grounds that it avoided a land invasion and saved all these lives. It was a post facto piece of propaganda. We've been hearing this lie now, as I've said, for almost 70 years. And it's about time someone pointed out this is a fabrication of the truth.
Yes, and I remember there was a huge controversy several years ago when the Smithsonian Institution mounted an exhibition of the Enola Gay and tried to include a more complete narrative of the story. And there was a firestorm of public opinion that reinforced the narrative that you've just exploded.
Yes, I'm fully aware of that fiasco, that the Smithsonian. And it was a great shame, too, because it could have been an immensely educative experience for people to see the truth about the bomb. Certainly not suggesting that those people who claim that there was some justice in the bomb, in using the bomb, are not sort of dismissing their beliefs as of the time. At the time, you could see why people thought that way, but 70 years on, we've got to start now looking at the documents. They've all been released. They're all available for public consumption. At the time, most Americans were strongly behind the bomb. They believed that this ended the war. They were swallowing the arguments that Truman was putting out in 1947. The majority of the press were behind it. Ironically, those who were actually against the bomb at the time were the right-wing press, not the left-wing press, there was a number of small right-wing magazines which were strongly opposed to the deliberate extermination of civilian life. But I digress. The point is that the Smithsonian exhibition should have gone ahead in its original form, and it's a great shame that it hasn't done. And as a result, we keep hearing this constant lie about which it seeks to justify this atrocity, and it was an atrocity. I mean, it is, to my mind, we debase ourselves and the history of human civilization if we accept that Japanese atrocities during World War II would warrant an American atrocity in reply. This was total war debased everyone.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Paul Hamm about his book, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, The Real Story of the Atomic Bombings and Their Aftermath. So why was there such an inexorable rush to using these weapons without warning against a civilian population? There were some alternatives discussed. Why were they not taken?
There was an extraordinary momentum towards using the atomic weapon. Everyone involved wanted it to be used. There's no doubt. There was no one standing and saying, "Well, we think this must be stopped. We shouldn't do it." Yes, there were some scientists who signed a petition. Some 68 scientists. Subsequently, the number rose. Who were powerless, and they were, physicists who had worked on the bomb. Some of them professed surprise that it was going to be actually used, which is not exactly credible, given that they certainly knew that, many of them knew that, the senior ones at least knew that it was a weapon to be used. If not on the Germans, then certainly on the Japanese. General Leslie Groves has to be introduced at this point, because this is a man of extraordinary energy, incredible drive, an appetite for work that is just gargantuan. And he was absolutely determined to use the bomb on the Japanese. He had immense power. He's one of the most powerful men in America at the time. One of the few to he ran the Manhattan Project, which was producing the atomic weapons. He was behind the testing of the bomb at Trinity in July 16th, 1945. And once it actually worked, once they saw the huge mushroom cloud rising over the desert near Albuquerque, down there, he was adamant that his first words, in fact, were, "Well, we drop two of those on Japan, war will be over." So from then on, there was nothing going to stop him. And in fact, he was determined to actually use it on Kyoto. That was one of the shortlisted target cities. Now, when I say the targeted cities, there was a thing called the Target Committee, which was running in parallel to all the scientific development of the bomb. And the Target Committee was a number of very high-powered scientists, including Oppenheimer, who was head of the scientific development of the bomb. This is Robert Oppenheimer, who led the scientific team involved. Now, he and a number of other scientists and political figures were on the Target Committee, and their job was not to question whether to use the bomb or how it should be used. That was the latter was a scientific issue. It was where it should be used, what should be the targets. That was its, as the name suggests, that was its job. Nobody on the committee ever once questioned whether it should be used on ethical grounds or even military grounds. It was simply a fait accompli in their minds. If it worked, it would be used. So narratives which try to point out, well, they were wrestling with other alternatives, or this was our least abhorrent choice, as Stimson put it in his 1947 Harper's article. He was trying to put across the notion that they'd been wrestling with all these alternatives. Well, no alternative was ever considered. Yes, a couple of voices raised the possibility of a warning, or maybe dropping it offshore on an island or on a proper military target. These were simply rejected very quickly. The idea of a warning that the bomb was dropped under the auspices of the United Nations was knocked on the head over lunch by James Burns, who would soon become the Secretary of State. This was in June, the exact date escapes me, late June, early July, 1945. And certainly he was adamant. Burns, this is James Burns, the Secretary of State from July the 1st, I think, was adamant that the bomb would be used. He was very hardline in support of its use. So once you had Leslie Groves, James Burns, and Truman, who effectively as president waved on the juggernaut. It already had its own momentum, and he, of course, took over the presidency at a time when he had very little power to stop that, even if he wanted to. So then came the Potsdam meeting in late July, the last 2 weeks of July 1945, in Potsdam in Berlin, where the three powers, the Soviet Union, Britain and America, issued to Japan the Potsdam Declaration, which said that Japan would suffer prompt and utter destruction unless it surrendered unconditionally. It didn't point out the form that destruction would take. There was no warning of the atomic bomb. The bomb would be used, but certainly Japan would not get any prior warning. Now, the Potsdam Declaration is interesting because the draft of the document included the Soviet Union's name. But the actual document, James Burns had removed the Soviet Union's name from it, which meant that Japan could sort of carry on imagining that it still had a neutrality pact, a neutrality agreement in place with the Soviet Union, that the Soviet Union did not threaten it. But quite the contrary. In fact, Stalin was mobilizing one of the biggest land armies the world had seen on the Soviet Japanese border in Manchuria. So there's no warning, and certainly there were no other alternatives considered. And this project took on a terrific momentum. Many of the scientists wanted to see it used. Many people did see it as a vast experiment. I mean, here effectively was a wasteland and a bored enemy who had inflicted terrible punishment and war crimes on American prisoners and Australian and British prisoners. So here we have a wasteland populated by our defeated enemy. Let us use the bomb on them, not just to try to wrest unconditional surrender from the Japanese, which didn't work, in fact, but also to draw a line in the sand or across the water to the Soviet Union, saying, effectively, don't mess with us, we have the bomb. Another reason which Truman used to justify it later was to avenge Pearl Harbor. Now, if it certainly did that, if you accept the rather outrageous and deeply inhumane conjecture that the complete destruction of two cities of civilians was proportionate retaliation for Pearl Harbor, then, well, I personally think you have a problem if you believe that, but many people do. But as I say, this was dropped without warning on a city of civilians. There was no, again, Hiroshima and Nagasaki had no military purpose in August 1945. Their military purpose had been removed as of late 1944. There were a few bedraggled soldiers left. The Nagasaki shipyard was not building any more ships. There was an underground torpedo factory in Nagasaki, which was still sort of limping along. But effectively, they were cities of civilians. And no warning. In other words, what this meant was no warning on Nagasaki, for example, was that the bomb fell on the educational and religious center of the city, wiping out in a matter of seconds around about 8,500 Nagasaki Catholics. This was the heart of Nagasaki Christendom. And they believed that they'd been spared from conventional bombardment up until that time because America felt a kinship with their religious history, which is one of the more brutal ironies of the war. So that's what no warning meant. And again, after the war, everyone came out of the woodwork to say, well, it was wrong, or we had to use it. It was our least abhorrent choice. There were other possible considerations which weren't workable. Well, they weren't even considered. The scientists were, to some extent, weeping crocodile tears over this because, you know, they were gung-ho for this to be used. And then speaking about how ashamed they were, one in particular, Oliphant, a physicist from Australia, was calling himself a war criminal. This was absurd. I mean, they knew what they were working on, and it was used. A lot of Jewish physicists were in a difficult moral conundrum because many of them had come out from Europe, you know, to escape Nazism, and thought that they were working on a bomb that would be used on the Germans. When they found that it would be used on the Japanese, many of them turned against it. So that raises the difficult question of, you know, is a nuclear weapon, you know, acceptable if it's going to be used on your personal enemies, or should it not be used at all? So all of these issues your question raises, and I'm sorry for the long answer, but it's certainly an extremely difficult issue for many people to this day.
Paul Hamm. We'll talk more with him about his book Hiroshima Nagasaki after the break. Don't go away.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard rain. They're gonna fall.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This week marks the 70th anniversary of the U.S. bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. My guest, Paul Hamm, examines the real story of the atomic bombings and their aftermath in his new book, Hiroshima Nagasaki. We've been talking about why did the U.S. drop such devastating weapons without warning on a civilian population. Now we turn to the question of what happened to those who were the victims of the bomb. We haven't yet talked about the victims. I think partly because that's a story that people are fairly familiar with. But you went back to interview scores of survivors. And of course, now these are survivors after a very long time, after some 70 years. I wonder if you could give us just one or two highlights from those interviews, Paul Hamm, that you did for the book.
I interviewed personally around 80 survivors. That's either face-to-face or via emails or on the telephone. And I was on the peace boat, in fact, which was a cruise ship, which was going around the world in 2009, I think it was. I took that boat from Sydney to Tokyo, and on board on that leg of the journey were 100 survivors of the atomic bombs doing, I suppose, a world tour, their last, you know, trip around the world. For many of them, it was the first opportunity to see another country. And I interviewed many of them in my cabin on the ship. And I'll never forget crossing storm-tossed seas of the South China Sea as we were approaching Japan with this woman in my cabin. I was filming her. She must have been, in her 80s. She was a teenager at the time of the bomb, and she was from Hiroshima. And she had undergone 16 plastic surgery operations on her face. The woman was still very badly scarred, but she showed me pictures of what she had looked like, and the hibakusha, as they're called, the bomb-affected people, were treated as the sort of one of them actually used this expression to me, so I'll use it, the elephant people of Japanese society, the people who were shunned because they were too appalling to look at. They couldn't go out in daylight, some of them, because they were monstrous in appearance. The bomb had so thoroughly disfigured their faces that many homes, you know, these were teenage girls and teenage boys, many of their homes removed all of the mirrors so that the children couldn't see themselves. It was that appalling. This woman had married, had had children. Her ending had been, for her, a very happy one. And yet she sat there talking to me about that day, August the 6th, 1945, in Hiroshima, as the ship was almost entering a death roll. I mean, it was heaving from side to side, and my cameraman was getting rather ill and looking rather green. And I had two interpreters, one doing the notes, one doing the voice, and we were all feeling a little ill, and she was completely oblivious. She talked and talked as if she was living through it that day. A most extraordinary woman, I'll never forget her. And There was another case I'll tell you briefly of a similarly aged woman, a lovely woman whom I got to know quite well, and she was a little girl at the time of the bomb, living in a village outside of Hiroshima with her mother and her brother, her elder brother and her elder sister. And her mother's husband had been sent off to war, and they'd never heard back from him. He'd presumably died in some ghastly Pacific island somewhere. The house was ruled by this particularly brutal stepfather who treated her. Her story sometimes came to mind like Cinderella's in a way, because she had these awful stepsisters who simply sent her out to work on the land on their little farm every day, and then she'd have to come back and cook for them all. And she was simply treated like the sort of like a peasant in their own family, and treated with absolute cruelty by this old man. But when the bomb was dropped and they had family, the sisters by that stage had moved to Hiroshima. And so this woman was forced by her stepfather to go into Hiroshima when they heard news of this strange super bomb, or this special weapon, as it was described at the time. No one knew it was atomic or believed it was atomic, and they were censored from saying so. But he forced her to take the children into Hiroshima the day after, the morning after, to find his daughters, her sisters-in-law. And thus began this terrified woman who was going to be beaten if she came home without any sign of the family. This terrified woman and her children, little children, was forced to walk around Hiroshima through this still, you know, roasting city, still with the residual radiation, with the most appalling scenes you can imagine, you know, huddles of the dead, piles of the dead. The children were wearing the straw sandals, which, you know, the peasantry in Japan at the time wore, the rural people. You know, they didn't have the money to afford proper sandals, so the hot earth, the hot ground quickly burnt through these sandals, and their feet were burning. The woman wandered around trying to find the home of the sister's home, and she couldn't find it because everything was complete rubble. They walked for many hours and in the end collapsed and slept in rubble. The children had seen the most, which I can't even relate, but I will say, you know, scenes such as children sitting by their dead parents, just hoping and waiting for them to wake up, thinking they're asleep. Some of their parents, you know, with their heads half off or their limbs off or burnt to a degree that is, you know, beyond third degree. It's right down to the bone. And these little children, often just babies screaming. So they're wandering around seeing these scenes. Horses, terribly, you know, the animal life was all completely burnt or mutilated or completely, you know, headless. Or some horses just wandering around. She remembered those scenes particularly. But they lay down to sleep on the side of the city and then wake up the next day. They woke up the next day and went back empty-handed to the village, whereupon she was beaten and lost hope and lost spirit, and a few years later died of radiation poisoning. The children, this one girl grew up and survived, and she got married and she had kids, and now she's a guide at the Hiroshima Museum, or she was when I was speaking to her. So that's a couple of stories to give you a sense of the kinds of experiences that these people had. Now, of the 80 particular cases, you know, I could go on and on, but I won't. There were, of course, some wonderfully uplifting stories as well. And just briefly, one of them, many of them were taken out to America. It was a group of, they were called rather painfully, the Hiroshima Maidens, to try to dress it up for American audiences. But they were brought out to America in the 50s and given free plastic surgery by American surgeons. And this was a charitable gesture. But unfortunately, it was sort of the whole experience wasn't left a rather bad memory, because they were put on television in silhouette and interviewed as if they were sort of, you know, a gallery of freaks. But of course, it was ultimately a good intentioned, and they went home to Japan with you know, a considerable improvement. At those days, of course, plastic surgery was in its infancy, but they were dealt with, and the most appalling results of the atomic weapon were checked, such as, you know, the inability to eat or blink. A lot of them just couldn't blink because their eyelids had been burnt off. So these things were corrected.
Wow, those are powerful stories. What are the lessons that you think we need in this contemporary world, in a world in which these weapons still exist and still pose a threat? What are the lessons that we need to take from the story?
It's a very good question, because I wrestled with this myself to draw a series of conclusions that I suppose chimed not only with our moral issue of atomic weapons, but the military issue, because the point of the book really is to dismantle, in the first instance, the military case for the bomb, because, you know, every weapon in the history of the world has been justified on military grounds. Poison gas was justified by God-fearing Christians during World War I. All the commanders were professed to be Christians and believers and prayed before battle, and yet they sent mustard gas and chlorine gas over the trenches to destroy, and the death by chlorine gas is unimaginable in its agony and in its prolonged agony and what happens to your actual lungs. And they were using this as now a banned weapon. But it didn't work. Poison gas didn't work. The casualties were very low. When I say it didn't work from a military point of view. Now, the atomic bomb didn't work from a military point of view. It didn't force Japan to surrender unconditionally. Japan surrendered with its sole condition intact, which was the life of the emperor, which we could get to later. But they surrendered 2 days after Nagasaki, once America had promised to hand them Hirohito's life. So it didn't force him to surrender. It merely killed, or merely, when I say merely, that is from the point of view of the Japanese leaders at the time, it killed another two cities in a list, as I've said, of 66 up until that point, comprising, in Hiroshima's case, 75,000 civilians instantly killed. In Nagasaki's case, 35,000 civilians instantly killed. Hundreds of thousands subsequently died from radiation poisoning and other cancers that were related to the bomb. Once you dismantled the military case for a weapon, certainly napalm did not work in Vietnam, and I won't go into that. I've written a book about Vietnam, but napalm bombing of villages simply drove thousands and thousands of South Vietnamese who were possibly loyal to the Americans and South Vietnamese into the hands of Ho Chi Minh. So it was a disaster from a military propaganda point of view to lay waste to entire villages. So what I'm sort of making out here is that there was no military case for these bombs. Once you strip that away, you are left glaring rather uncomfortably at, well, why did we use them? What is therefore left to justify this? And of course, there's nothing left. We are left with our moral anguish and the precedent of having used these weapons to no good effect militarily against, if not soldiers, as in World War I, then certainly against hundreds of thousands of civilians in World War II. That goes for the incendiary raids, the firebombing of the cities, as much as it goes for the nuclear destruction of the cities. And so then we have to ask ourselves, well, to what purpose are we going to use this power? And a lot of the arrogance of human beings astonishes me, because after the bombs were tested, you know, they were almost dancing with delight at what this meant and the power they suddenly felt they had over nature, as one of them said. You know, this is extraordinary power we now hold over nature, and failing to realize that this meant that nature now had immense power over us. Mm. And that is the real, I suppose, environmental lesson we have to take from it. The bomb, the release of atomic power has immense power over us, and it is up to us to contain that power somehow. Now, that sort of dovetails very well with the moral issue. Do we actually, to what extent do we value human life on this planet and animal life? Those are the questions that have to be asked when we speak of nuclear weapons and their use in the future. And I think that the book draws the conclusion in my chapter called Why, and in the last chapter, that these were war crimes by any definition. I mean, there is a Hague Convention which defines war crimes very clearly, and anyone who tries to sort of fudge that is deluding themselves. These were war crimes. That is not to say the Japanese weren't unleashing horrific war crimes on the Allies. I've written two books about Japanese war crimes. I don't need to be lectured by anyone about what the Japanese did in the Pacific, as a lot of people said to me, well, Mr. Ham, you know, what about what the Japanese did here and here in Bataan, in Borneo, in New Guinea? You know, I've written books about these experiences. So what I'm speaking from some experience of what a war crime is. And the extraordinary thing is it does not, as I've said earlier in this interview, to match Japanese atrocities with an atrocities of our own doesn't get us anywhere morally. It completely debases our sense of ourselves. America could have adopted moral high ground in this war. They could have restrained themselves and thought, we will offer Japan a demonstration of our power, of what we have discovered, of what we are capable of unleashing. We will do this under the auspices of the United Nations, and we will have observers from around the world. As things stand, the war is at a stalemate. Japan's islands are incapable of offensive action. Yes, the war's still going on the islands, but if they were to be able to bring together a demonstration, then we would have seen America going down in history as an extraordinary example to the world of moral restraint. But instead, we had this blind momentum towards a war crime and an atrocity in answer, in many people's minds at the time, to Japanese atrocities. And what did it achieve? What did it achieve? It, as I've said, it did not end the war. It certainly did not end the war. The samurai leaders of Japan were intent on continuing the war for as long as it took. They were preparing to fight against a nuclear-armed America. The radio broadcasts were saying to people after Nagasaki and after Hiroshima, be prepared for this sort of projectile landing on your cities. Make sure you cover your faces with towels. Don't glare, don't look into the fireball. I mean, these messages were going out. They were going to fight on and on and on until America delivered the sole condition which they were relying upon to end the war, and that was, as I've said, the life of their emperor, who was regarded as a living god. It was as if we were, imagine if we were defending, if Jesus Christ had come back to life and we were asked to defend his life, I mean, what would we be prepared to do? And I've made this point in other interviews. Well, we'd probably fight on and on and on, especially a Christian country such as America. And that is the prism through which one has to look at Japan's determination to continue fighting, through the eyes of the ordinary Japanese person who believed that they were fighting for the life of a living God.
So, in fact, we could have granted that sole condition. Truman was well aware that that was the condition, and, in fact, that condition was granted.
It was granted, absolutely, after Nagasaki. Had it been granted earlier, before the bombs were used, and let's play it's a counterfactual argument. But let's look at what if they had granted that condition at Potsdam, in the sort of ultimatum-like language of James Burns, which he used on the 11th of August when he did actually grant the life of the emperor. Had he used that that offer, as it effectively was, before the bomb, and had America continued its naval blockade, which of course they would have done, and had Russia made clear its intention to come into the war, which, remember, had been denied, that knowledge had been denied the Japanese because America had struck Russia's name off the Potsdam Declaration. So the greatest sanction to Japan continuing the war, the fear of Russia, they were terrified of the communist invasion, had been denied, had been removed, which is extraordinary given that Truman professed to have gone to Potsdam to get Russia into the war. Once the bomb was tested, he didn't want Russia in the war. But the point is, had those three components been in place before the bomb was used, the life of the emperor, the naval blockade, and Russia's entry to the war, then there's no doubt in my mind, and to any sentient human being who looks at this clearly and reads the documents, Japan would have surrendered because they were on their knees and they were literally begging through their intermediaries for a negotiated peace. But their only negotiation, their only condition was Hirohito's life. And everyone in Washington who understood Japan, or even those who didn't understand Japan but had read the basic information they needed to know about how to control Japan after the war, they knew they needed Hirohito because he was the only one who could have controlled the fanatical elements on the ground. Had the Allies, when I say we, meaning America, Britain, Australia, and the rest of the Allies, beheaded or hung Hirohito as a war criminal, the most incredible uprising would have occurred. It would have gone on for decades and decades. We would never have been able to control Japan in the peace. So they all knew they had to give Hirohito his life, but they prolonged that condition until after the bombs were used. We can read into that all sorts of conjecture. I have no evidence to say that Burns prolonged the gift of the emperor's life so that the bombs could be used. That is a callous reading of his motives. There's no paper, no document which suggests that that is his intention. Other writers have suggested that was his intention. I haven't said that because I haven't got the evidence, and I can't say that. And I'd rather give our political leaders the benefit of the doubt until I see the evidence to the contrary. In this case, James Burns was an extraordinary private man and got rid of a lot of his papers. He also wanted to end the war on America's terms, which is the conclusion I've drawn, that he prolonged the war, and he did prolong it by striking Russia's name off the Potsdam Declaration. That prolonged the war. And having prolonged it, he was determined to end it on America's terms. And I can see his point of view. He didn't want Russia in at the peace. As Stalin put it, you know, he certainly wanted a slice of Japan after the armistice.
Well, this is an incredibly important story, Paul Hamm. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, the real story of the atomic bombings and their aftermath. I want to thank you so much for enlightening us about this real history and for coming out to talk with us here at Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much, and your questions have been wonderful. It's a pleasure to have been given the chance to talk it through. Thank you.
Paul Hamm. In addition to Hiroshima, Nagasaki, his books include 1914, The Year the World Ended, Vietnam, The Australian War, and Kokoda.
Everybody's worried about the atomic bomb, but nobody's worried about the day my Lord will come, when he'll hit great God Almighty like an atom bomb. When he comes, when he comes.
In 1945, the atom bomb became alive. In 1949, the USA got very wide. They found a country across the line had an atom bomb of the very same kind. The people got worried all over the land, just like folks got in Japan.
Next up, in light of President Obama's announcement of a tougher policy on climate change, we play a clip from our 2014 interview with Naomi Klein about her award-winning book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate. You say in This Changes Everything, we are at decade zero. You know, I have even seen credible scientists say that we basically have until 2017 to turn this around, a mere 2 years away.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit, just very briefly, why decade zero? What do you mean by that?
Well, decade zero, because, you know, we are the, you know, the college student that's asked for extension after extension after extension on their term papers, and we're, you know, we're finally out of time, right? There's a way in which we always talk about emission reductions being something off in the future. You know, it's 50% by 2050 or 2030 or 2080. It's never now. And we've gotten to the point where we have allowed emissions to go up instead of stabilizing them or gradually reducing them, that we now, if we're going to stay within our global carbon budget, which would give us a 50-50 chance of keeping temperatures below 2 degrees warming, and that's a target that our governments have already agreed to. It's actually quite a dangerous target, 2 degrees Celsius, because we're already seeing very dangerous impacts with warming at, you know, 0.7 Celsius. So, you know, why would we want to more than double that? But that's what we've agreed to do. And if we're serious about that, what we know is that we have to start cutting our emissions immediately by 8 to 10% a year, or else we will have waited so long that we'll have to cut so quickly that it's basically impossible, right? If you wait till the last minute, it's like, you know, if you wait till 5 minutes before your term paper's due, you can't actually write it. It takes time, and it takes time to wean ourselves from fossil fuels. Already talking about 8 to 10% reductions a year, you know, is a massive challenge. It is, however, possible. But, you know, the reason why my book is called This Changes Everything is because it isn't possible to meet those targets without changing our economic system. Our economic system is not built for that kind of deliberate strategic planning where we choose to contract parts of our economy and expand other parts of our economy, where we very forcefully regulate powerful corporations. You know, we've been going in the opposite direction. So either we allow everything to change about our physical world, because we're now on a trajectory towards 4 to 6 degrees Celsius of warming. That's catastrophic. That changes everything about our world. Or we accept that physical reality and we change the rules of economics, which actually can be changed, unlike the laws of nature.
Right. I mean, you point out that the climate crisis happened both because of and at the same time as you know, the worst possible moment when we had deregulated capitalism. It doesn't sound as if you're saying that capitalism itself, in other words, that individual entrepreneurs who may establish green businesses mm-hmm. have to be done away with. We are not really talking about command and control, economic so-called communism. What exactly are you talking about?
And yes.
Show us a pathway from the system we have now to where we can go.
So, you know, when the subtitle of the book is Capitalism versus the Climate, and I think when some people hear that, it's just like, oh, okay, she's saying we need, you know, state socialism, and, you know, that's not going to do it either. That state socialism, industrial socialism on the Soviet model was disastrous for the environment. And really what is at the heart of this is a mindset that sees the earth really as infinite and sees humanity's role as being able to, you know, endlessly extract without giving back. And so we need to shift from an extractivist economy to a regenerative economy. And, you know, in terms of this challenge, it's complicated because on the one hand, if we think about this bad timing, that if we want to understand this failure, we have to look at it in the context of when this crisis hit us and this terrible case of bad timing that climate change has suffered from, in that it hit us, it landed on our laps in the late 1980s, which was the triumphant moment for deregulated capitalism. So if it had hit us in the 1970s when it was still, you know, not a dirty word to interfere in the market and regulate corporations and to pass laws like the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and so on, then maybe we would have responded to the crisis quite differently. The problem now is that we suffer from a procrastination penalty, which is a term that Michael Mann uses, the climate scientist Michael Mann at Penn State University, is a great scientist and a great writer who wrote The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And the procrastination penalty means, you know, when you do nothing about the problem and indeed go in the wrong direction and allow emissions to increase year after year, global emissions have gone up by around 65% in the years since our governments have been meeting to try to solve this problem. And greenhouse gases, the problem with that is that they stay up there. You know, this is the crux of it, is that carbon stays in the atmosphere for hundreds of years. So as we have failed, we have made the problem worse. We have made our challenge worse. And now it's not just a challenge to this particular post-Keynesian sort of extreme capitalism that says there's something wrong with regulation. It's actually a challenge to the core logic of growth above all else that is really at the center of our economic system. So it isn't just deregulated capitalism. I would argue that it is a challenge to capitalist logic itself, which elevates growth to the main goal of our economic system. That said, I don't think this is about abolishing markets, abolishing private property. It's about changing the mix. And certainly, private companies can be part of the solution to climate change, but we can't leave the climate crisis to the market as our, you know, current ideology would have us do, creating market-based solutions, creating, you know, emission trading schemes, carbon offsets, all of these ways in which we've tried to reconcile market logic with a crisis that is just frankly, you know, too big for that.
That was a clip from our 2014 interview with Naomi Klein about her book, This Changes Everything. It's just been issued in paperback. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.